I think I've got the mic working now. Great. Thank you very much for that, David. It was brilliant, as usual. Your dad's just telling me to stand next to you. What I like really about David is how he brings some language into it that I keep on looking for in my Bible. I haven't found push off yet, but David says it was there somewhere. But he brings his own sort of character into these Bible studies, but always focuses at the end on the one who died for us, Jesus. That's sort of absolutely brilliant. I can't remember whether I read or listened to it somewhere, but someone did make the comment, if you count up the number of offerings that the Israelites are supposed to bring, it's a surprise that McDonald's ever got in on the act. But
yeah, you do wonder, but unfortunately you weren't allowed to eat most of it.
Oh, so we're making up for it now. Right, we've got one question down here, David.
Yeah, just wondering, God is, as you say, a compassionate God, and he says that he will give you the desires of his heart, etc., etc. I'm just interested to hear that when the people were crying out for meat, you said that God seemed to consider that they were whinging and then went the opposite way and gave them more meat than they needed. And also when they were crying out for water, that that was seen as a whinge and things. I was a bit confused about all that, because I would have thought eating and drinking are fundamental things that we all need. And why is it considered a sin when it's something that we all need, basically?
Well, I think the answer to that quite simply is it's considered a sin because when they come to Moses and say, give us water, there's no water here, they're not actually doing it in a way that says, will you ask God to provide for us? They come to him and say, we hate it here, there's no water, this is all your fault. It's the way they're asking that's the problem. It's done in anger, it's done in complaint, it's not done in a case of, in a sense of, will you give us something because we need it? It's a case of, we shouldn't be here. We should be in Egypt. And anyway, we don't trust God because he's not fed us. He's not given us water. That's the problem. The problem is that you are supposed to trust God after all he's done for you, and they still don't seem to be able to. Wouldn't it have driven you mad if you were Moses?
Right, I've got one on the internet here, a question for you. It says, approximately how many generations of Israel went through the wilderness?
Pardon?
Approximately how many generations went through the wilderness?
Okay, it's not entirely clear, I don't think, but I would say we're getting to about three. So we've got the young and the old who came out of Egypt, and their children, who of course went with them. So we've got three generations in the wilderness. By the time you get to the end of Numbers, you've got one, which is basically the generation who grew up in the desert. Now, exactly how true that is another question altogether. The story isn't there for you to say, well, it was exactly this number, it was exactly that number. That's not what the numbers are there for. The story is, and the point being made, that in any sense of the word, the older generation who could complain, who had come out of Egypt with Moses, apart from Caleb and Joshua, didn't see the promised land because they didn't trust God to give it to them.
Here's a cup of water.
Mm-hmm.
Do you need some water?
Yes, please.
Hang on.
Thank goodness you didn't have to strike the rock for that water. No, but I was going to say, the book of Numbers really does show God's wrath as well as his compassion, because that is something that we in the church don't like to discuss, or even in general Christianity, we don't like to discuss. Would you say this is a good example of the wrath of God? And do you think that he's almost losing his temper when he says he's going to kill them, going to kill them all before he breaks his promise? When he says he's going to kill them and almost breaks his promise?
Just a minute. I'm actually trying to find something which I think really, really sums up, what this actually does show about God. Because I think Moses says it quite well. But to begin answering your question, the problem is the Western Church is very fond of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And we're told it's the golden rule. Actually, it's not the golden rule Jesus gives us. It's just one of his pieces of advice. We're told that we need to be humble. We're told we need to be kind to each other, which is all true. But in the letters where Paul tells the churches to be humble and kind, he's often started by telling them off for false teaching and essentially saying, I do not want to see false teaching in your church. I do not want to see people who treat the false teachings allowed in your church. Get rid of them. Both of those things are true. And that's the bit that we don't like. We want one bit to be true. People who like judgment, like things like the wrath of God. People who like to be right, very much like the wrath of God. People who think that we should all just get along, like the gentler side. But they have to exist alongside one another. You can't have one and not the other and say one's the Old Testament, one's the New Testament. That's not the way it is. So, this is the bit I was looking for. Verse 18 in the book of Numbers, chapter 14. Moses says, the Lord is slow to anger, abounding in love and forgiving the sin and rebellion. Yet he does not let the guilty go unpunished. He punishes the children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sin of the people just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now. So in other words, if you do commit sin, there are consequences. He's not just going to take those away from you. He will forgive, but there'll still be consequences. Moses made a mistake. There were consequences for that mistake. If a pastor makes a mistake that damages his ministry, the damage is done. He probably will repent, and we all hope that any pastor who does something like that will repent, but they may have to leave that ministry. They may not be able to carry on with that church. They may not be able to keep that position they had. Their reputation may be down the tube. That's the way it is, unfortunately. But we should be grateful that we have a God who forgives us for those mistakes instead of saying, oh, well, I'll wash my hands on you then.
Thank you for that, David. Any more questions?
Following on from that point, really, I think the key thing that runs through the Old Testament and especially in Numbers is that God is God, as I think really you were saying at one point, David, and he will not let other people take his honour and his glory. And this is, to me, what a lot of the issue with hitting the rock for the water was about. It's because Moses said, shall we give you water? There was no recognition in what he said to the people that it was God who was providing. And I think we see that throughout the story, that as soon as the people start wandering in disobeying God's laws and going to bed with the opposition, they are losing sight of who God is, and God no longer has honour as he should have. And being God, that's the number one thing that we should give God.
Yeah.
Because he is so much greater than we are. We are his created things. We did not create God. He created us.
That's just it. I do think that Western society encourages people to believe that they have the authority to tell God exactly how he should do things. And a cursory reading of any books in the Bible will tell you that that's not how it works. You know, look at Jesus. When Jesus had just named the 12 and had just said to Peter, you're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not withstand it. Then he tries to explain to the disciples that he's going to be crucified, and Peter isn't having it. In fact, Peter essentially says, you can't say that because God won't let that happen. And Jesus is so annoyed, he turns to Peter and says, get behind me, Satan. It's the same principle that you just mentioned. God is God, and you have to let him be God, even when society says that actually we should be God.
Can I ask a totally unrelated, very specific question? I find it very interesting that Balaam, it might be an amusing story, but the strange thing is that he was not an Israelite, but he was a prophet who heard from God.
Yeah, the story of Balaam is really, really interesting. I was wondering if I could talk about it, but I decided that I didn't have time. And I think I actually forgot about it when I was trying to get everything else sorted. Here you have a pagan prophet who hears from God, but even though he does hear from God, and even though he does say the things God tells him to say, which is a hint that God speaks to people who aren't Israelites. Well, we know that Job wasn't an Israelite anyway. But in Jude and in Revelation, Balaam is seen as a person who made the wrong decisions and didn't obey God. So when Jesus is talking to one church, he says, nevertheless, I have this against you. You have people there who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who talked Balak to deceive Israel via sexual immorality and food sacrificed to idols. So yes, this guy hears from God, even though he clearly doesn't quite understand who God is and what that means he ought to do. So don't assume God will only talk through people who you like and who belong to you. He may talk to you through someone who you really can't stand and who believes the opposite of everything you believe.
Back to Samuel now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a good example of that is Richard Dawkins, because he's an atheist, but he has made several very good points in society. And he's been condemned for it, but he says a lot of the same things that, well, not same things, but he says some very good points. And that's an example of what you're saying.
Mm. Yep. You can sometimes get real wisdom or real gems from somebody who's not a believer, because if God needs to get a message through to you, he will. The one other angle you can see on Balaam is, here are the Israelites going about their everyday life, getting the manna, washing the clothes, feeding the baby, traveling from place to place, completely unaware at the time that Balak, king of Moab, wanted to curse them and wanted to bring ruin on them. And God was saying, oh, no, you don't.
Are there any more questions?
Have you got any for me?
Well, one of the things that I was remember reading was to do with these towns that were meant to be places you could flee to if you'd murdered, place of sanctuary.
Ah, yes.
And I don't know where my local one is, do you?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me about that. I did want to do it, but I thought we were getting a bit short on time again. It's really interesting, isn't it, that one of the things that God seems to think is really important is justice. In the days when you didn't have a police force or you didn't have an army as it would recognise, essentially if you killed, it worked like this. Kill one of my family and I'll kill you. And somebody would come and be allowed to essentially act like a bounty hunter and kill you because you'd murdered somebody who belonged to your family. To prevent people who had done it by mistake, you know, you drop a tile off your roof, say, and you don't notice that somebody's walking underneath it and you suddenly realise you've smashed somebody's skull. That can happen. It's tragic whenever it does. By the standards of those days, once you'd done that, you were a dead man because they'd kill you. But this time, God actually says, no, there needs to be a place where they can go and where they can stay so they can live because it was an accident. It's a kind of level of justice in society you don't see in many other places. So in chapter 34, he goes into great lengths about how that's meant to work, as well as telling the Israelites to give the Levites towns to live in. And he also tells the, Joshua, actually, and Deuteronomy both talk about this and both partition the land to make sure they get it. Oh, and one of the reasons for the numbers actually is so that you could see how the land was divided up. God tells Israel how to divide up the land also in Numbers 34. Oh, sorry, and the slayer was actually Numbers 35.
Thanks for that, David. Any other questions? We've got one at the back here.
Thank you, David. Thank you so much. It's not a question. I just wanted to share two comments. In Psalm 95, it says in verse 7b and verse 8, today, if you hear God's voice, don't harden your hearts as you did in Meribah. And then there is a little footnote saying Meribah here means quarreling. I just find that quite interesting. I'm not sure who wrote Psalm 95, I have to admit. It's not a Psalm of David, but it's written much later. And then the place Meribah has become a word in the Hebrew language, which then means quarreling. And I have one more point. We do have a window here at St. Mark's with Moses raising the snake in the desert.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I've actually started learning to speak Hebrew. I've been working on it for... Oh, no, I can't admit this. I can't admit I've been working on Hebrew since 2016. It makes me feel old. Can't I pretend I started it yesterday? Yeah, sorry, guys, had to do that. Okay, it's really fascinating how a lot of the words you find in modern Hebrew, which hasn't actually been around for very long, are words that originate from the Bible. And the traditions of the traditions you find in the Psalms and all the rest of it do come from the Torah. So people who wrote these Psalms or were prompted to write them for whatever reason obviously did know about the story of Meribah and what that meant, or have some idea of what it meant, because they didn't know who Jesus was. And God can use that. And it's an important passage. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart. The New Testament writers used it quite a lot. And yes, the symbol of the snake is fascinating. It seems rather unusual to a lot of us. But then there's nothing wrong with having an emblem of the cross to look up to occasionally or to hang around your neck, provided it doesn't become something traditional and something you worship. All worship has the danger of becoming the thing you worship instead of the creator. And I think that's the message from that.
Anyhow, I think we've got to the end of our time now. Graham's just having a look to see what time it is. Oh, okay. But
it's 8:05.
Yeah. Mm. If there's one thing, find from the book of Job is this, going through it, this fact that although God pronounces judgment, at the same time he provides us with a way through. And you know, the snakes, when they're biting people, that was his judgment, but he provided a way for them to be healed as well. And yeah, we see that in the cross, don't we? There's judgment, but also that way of victory coming through the cross for us. Thank you so much for tonight, Dave.